Welcome, welcome, welcome to a new episode of the State of Flux podcast. What a treat it was to get to pick the brain of my friend King Green this month. You may know him from fronting Red Gold Green or his work as a solo artist, but he also recently launched the King Green Show, which I absolutely love. He's had a super interesting career with Red Gold Green, from getting 100,000 organic views in 2 days on their first song, to working through the major label system and collaborating with Dave Grohl and Pharrell, and back to taking control of their career as independent artists. Tons of great stories and lessons to be learned there, but my favorite part of the podcast was getting deeper into his philosophy on music, work ethic, and technology. So excited for you guys to hear this one, so.
Are you ready?
I'm doing good. I was just saying that I wasn't being in Hollywood. I can't find my regular glasses. I need a prescription.
Future's so bright, you got to wear sunglasses inside.
All right. I'll be blind while I look at you.
All right, cool. Well, I think a good place to start here is going back to all the Red Gold Green stuff before we get into all the awesome stuff you're doing with the King Green Show now. So one thing I did want to ask, what is the origins of the name Red Gold Green? And is there any tie back to the Culture Club lyric on Karma Chameleon?
No, there's no tie back to the Culture Club lyric, even though everybody talks about that. We were in a band locally that was doing really well called the 5-1, and we had some viral type of moments in the blog era and stuff like that. And the 5-1s represented the 51st state, because we were from the DC area. We heard of how the Roots were like this backing band in the core of all that Philly scene when they were coming up. Even Jill Scott, by doing stuff, they would all jam and play together and all that, and play shows and all that. And we were trying to be that, and was that, for the DC area. So like, every rapper that came out of DC that became anything, we did these open mics where they would play, but we were the backing band, and then we would play our songs in the middle, and we would be playing like weird ass, like Vampire Weekend covers, but with rap verses. It was weird as shit. So that was us, and we developed a fan base. It was red, blue, green, and gold, the four colors in the band, and we represented the 5-1. Blue left, so this entire area knew us as the colors, so we would continue to have that love from our area, but we had that name. So it's just that simple.
What was with removing the vowels?
There was all these bands at the time that had no vowels, and we thought that that might be cool instead of like just saying Red, Gold, Green, because we wanted to separate ourselves from like reggae identity or the Pan-African identity, because we wanted to kind of have our own. When you think of Red, Gold, Green as us, you think of RDGLDGRN, which was dumb as hell, but it worked at the same time. But it's a stupid ass thing.
It works though, man. You hear Red, Gold, Green, you think about you guys with the spelling of the conversation topic. It's interesting. It's not like your name is like The Boys, where there's 8 billion other bands named that, and you Google it and God knows what shows up, you know?
If you Google us, it's just us. Yeah, that was kind of our whole thing. And we were like, if we put in the work, and because of our ambition and I would say somewhat of our talents, it was able to work out for us at a high level, but we probably would be more successful earlier on if we didn't have that name, I guarantee it.
Yeah.
But it don't matter. Yeah. Like the head of Universal asked us, he goes, why don't you change the name? Like once we were about to drop our record, he stopped into the meeting and just goes, y'all haven't thought about changing the name? And then in my brain, I'm like, yeah, if the head of Universal said it, maybe we should change the name. In the end, it's cool that it is what it is.
You mentioned how the 5-1 was 51st state, DC, DC, DMV, that whole area is very much ingrained in you guys. You guys rep it really well. A big part of that I find super interesting is the way you guys incorporate the go-go sound.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people don't know about what go-go is, right? So for the people who do not understand, and to be 100% honest, I have an idea of what it is, but I probably don't even know exactly what it is, you know? So
yeah.
What is the go-go sound, and how did you guys factor that in right from the beginning?
Go-go is something that started, I would say, late 70s, 80s, when hip-hop started in the DC area. And you got the forefathers like Trouble Punk and Chuck Brown and these bands, or EU with the song Doing the Butt. That was like a big song. And a lot of people in hip-hop borrowed from go-go sound. Even New Jack Swing, it could be considered a subgenre of go-go almost, even though some people might think that's sacrilegious. But go-go started at that time and grew mainly in the DC, Maryland, and in Virginia area. There's been spurts of when there was a pop song by a producer from DC who put a little go-go sound within a pop song, but it's never became a worldwide genre. But it's always been in DC, and that's something that is just beautiful. Being in Virginia, if you listen to the radio, goes on at night, right? So we all are being like indoctrinated with this music from and this culture from this area. So it's something that we just loved because it was only us. And when you started thinking about your high school life and your high school friends and everybody listening to this or going to a go-go, like you actually go to a go-go, like that's a place where they're going to only play go-go music. At the time, they were hella violent. It was like the realest place in the world. And you had some of the best times of your life at a go-go. So it's something ingrained in us. So we took a lot of styles and rhythms from that music and put it in on our own. And we never wanted to consider ourselves as a go-go band, but some people like actually even think of us in that way. And a lot of real go-go artists give us respect for taking these rhythms and putting it in rock and pop music and rap music.
Was that the scene that you guys came out of then? Like when you were playing as 5-1 and you were a local DC band, was it mostly playing with other go-go stuff?
Not at all. We were hybrid, but it was really hip hop and rap. Because at the time, Wale was just bubbling up. We're talking blog era, right? That's when we started the 5-1. So we were doing our thing during the blog era, and it was all in this hybrid hip hop situation. We just had these go-go elements because we came from the area. There's even like Wiz Khalifa had these YouTube vlogs or whatever that he was doing at the time. And he was at South by Southwest when we were there. And we were like jamming to go-go in our little van. And it's in his vlog because we was like in the middle of the streets going crazy. And even the people who were like filming the vlog were like, yeah, I know about go-go. They were talking about the genre because we were wild at the time. And we were in the streets just blasting go-go in South by Southwest. So it was not so much in the scene, but just showing our appreciation for the music no matter where we went, which is still what we do.
And with that local scene, obviously you guys had a little bit of a reputation before you guys broke. You guys had the song I Love Lamp that put you guys on the map. You self-produced, self-directed the video, and you just put it up on YouTube, and it got 100,000 views in a matter of days, right?
Yeah, it was like a day or two. YouTube and Facebook were like TikTok now, right? So back at that time, we just were sharing the video with all of our friends on Facebook. We literally was listening to Juicy J, Who the Neighbors. We sat down, the three of us at a table, and shared it with every single person that we knew. The next day, they shared it with every single person. It just kept on going. Like, we shared it all. And since it was good, everybody started sharing it. And then the third day, the video was out. I wake up on Red's mom's couch and got an email from every single label in the universe. And then we took down the video because they wanted to re-put the video under their thing. Then they took down the video again. Like, the video right now should have like 10 million views if we didn't take it down because of stupid label shit.
And was that kind of expected for you guys? When you put out the video, what was your expectation of how it would do?
We thought people locally would know it. That's it. We just wanted the fan base. Like, we were bringing 700 people to a show in DC. So that's pretty good, right? We wanted those 700 people to still fuck with us. That's it. That was the only goal. And we had a Ning site, which is basically like your own type of MySpace. And we had like 1,500 people in this community. So Discord before Discord, we had like 1,500 people that were in that thing. And we were like building our community, which is what we're trying to redo again now. Because all these things came out and you thought you were building a community on Instagram. You think you're building a community on Facebook. And then they're just like, no, this is our community and you're paying for it. And so we had our own. So we just wanted to service those people. That was it.
Do you think it was the community that made that I Love Lamp video viral?
Community is always what makes, I think, anything bubble. Nowadays, because of how the algorithms change because of TikTok, you could have no followers at all, put out something and then go viral, right? But it doesn't last because there's no community behind it. When there's a community behind it, that's when it actually can last and actually become something, I think. So that's what I always felt was important. And we just like treat people good. We treat people like friends because that's how I see it. Your fans and supporters as friends. You know what I'm trying to say? More so than like this weird hierarchy thing that seems like it's been going on. Like, people really think it's like, oh, I love my fans in a way that it's like they're beneath you, where it seems like they're the most important part. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you didn't stream your song a million times. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? A million people streamed your song and now you're, and so they're actually the most important part. And That almost seems cliche, but that's like the reality and people just don't even think about it.
That's something else I really love about what you're doing at the King Green Show too. A lot of the videos you put out, it's kind of unprecedented the amount of access you give your followers to your process and to the music and everything. So you're continuing that today. But again, before we get into the King Green Show, I want to stay on the Red Gold Green stuff for a little bit. So I Love Lamp comes out, goes viral. Huge moment for you guys. The label start calling. You end up getting the chance to record at Sound City, which in itself is something special to have the chance to do that. But then you're in there, you're recording with Kevin Agunis, and you end up with Dave Grohl on your debut album. You end up with Pharrell doing tracks with him. Was the label involved in that? Were the label opening doors for you? Or was it just kind of you vibed with these people, you connected, and they ended up on the record?
Now, the music business is incestuous. Who is our label? Who is our management is a very interesting thing. So we signed to a management, AAM, which is usually production and songwriter management, big songwriters like Dr. Luke and things like that. So we signed to them as like one of their first primary acts. So they didn't have that many artists on their roster. So they were like using all their production and songwriter pull to hold us down as an act. So one of the producers that they had signed to that management company was Kevin Agunis. And Kevin Agunis put himself in position to have sub-label under Republic Records, the Universal Republic, the record company that Drake and Weeknd's on. So Kevin heard about us being signed to this management company, was like, these guys are dope because they're bringing rock and hip-hop together. They're doing something new, and I want to sign them to our label. We're like, we already got major labels trying to get at us. So like, what's good with you? He's like, well, we are a major label, but we can work like an indie, blah, 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 blah. We had to sign like an NDA because someone who's signed to our management company was also our label head. So think about that, right? So we signed like an NDA. It was very, like I said, incestuous. And that was that type of situation. So within that, since Kevin Agunis owned Sound City, or what used to be Sound City, Dave Grohl was doing that documentary. Kevin Agudis was told us when he came over to rest in Virginia to sit with us to try to get us signed. Like, it was old school shit. Hey, we really want you to be a part of this label type shit. So he came into our area. So we sat at dinner. He was like, I'm thinking that we could have Dave Grohl drum on this shit. You're talking to three guys from Virginia. We're like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. You sound like you just shit. But whatever, bro. Like that. And then he sends us an email of him sending the song to Grohl, and Grohl sends an email back and says, oh yeah, I'm busy working on FF right now, but I love this song. Let's do something. And we're like, everything sounded right. The people at the management group, X was working there at one point. And so we had, there was good people around us and good energy. So we decided to go with them. That led into us meeting Grohl, working at Sound City. Since we were signed to Fairfax Records, which is Kevin Agunis' label, which is a subsidiary of Universal Republic, we met with them before. They were sharing our songs to producers and people because they're like, oh, these are new artists that we have. Pharrell was in the building in a meeting getting all these new artists. So out of all those new artists he saw, he was like, I want to work with them. I want to make a whole album with them. That's what he said to them. And then what actually happened is Pharrell hit up Kevin Agunis telling them that, yo, you want to work with us? Kevin came with us to work with Pharrell. After the first day we worked with Pharrell, we found out that Pharrell wanted to produce the whole album with us, which we would prefer over anybody else in the world, right? So we kind of got blocked from that situation, is what I'm trying to say, by the label. So then we worked with Pharrell, did one song. He hits us up again and says, love the song, let's work again. We go to another studio in LA and work with him for like another couple of days. The shit was great. He was telling us about Miley Cyrus was there. The few days earlier, he was working with, what's his name? The big song that he got sued for. Blurred Lines, he was working with Robin Thicke. He was working with Chase. Like he's like a doctor going from room to room, just making hits at this time. And then you saw how it was working, and that work paid off like a year or 2 years later. Like he had Happy, Blurred Lines, Get Lucky. We saw the work, and then it was a crazy just to see that growth, and because his mindset was just, yo, let's just get it. That's how all that shit happened. It just being shared within the industry. That's where we were known more than within in the streets. Like we got people to listen and view it, and it was before streaming. That was our issue. We were just 2 years before or 2 years later, we'd have been straight. it was before streaming. No one knew what to do. It was all blog errors. Like, oh, we're going to get all the blogs to talk about you and then all that type of stuff. It needed a plan, but we were just in the industry. People just sharing the music.
Yeah. And even after you left the major label system, you maintained that fan base. And something you just said that I think is super interesting is you talked about Pharrell just working his ass off, going room to room, and you know, you saw that pay off. So as you guys were transitioning back to independent artists and taking full control of your career, what were those lessons like, that work ethic you learned from Pharrell, that you're just like, we can do this on our own and this is how we're gonna do it?
Yeah, you can do anything if you put the work into it. Like, I've seen it anytime I or we have actually work, because when you're with a team, all of you guys got to work, right? When we all work, the fruits come. You have to have the skill set, you got to have the ambition, and you've got to put in the work, and then it'll come. Now, a lot of times work harder than smarter, but it's there. I saw that with Pharrell. I saw that with other bands. I saw that with Foo Fighters, like seeing them live and what made them a great live band. It's not like they're not great musicians. It's not like they're over here doing the greatest musical feats in the world. But that performance and that connection with the crowd, I haven't seen ever actually live anybody play like the Foo Fighters play and have that connection with the crowd. That's the most important thing about a live show, is how do you connect with 80,000 people or 80 people. I've seen them in a room of 800 people, and I've seen them in a stadium, 15, 20,000 people. Probably like, it was more than 15, 20,000 people. It was like, RFK was like probably 40. But anyways, yeah. And it felt the same. Felt like Grohl's talking to you. Feels like the band's playing these songs that you love because you love them, and it's a conversation. So that's an important thing I think I learned more than anything. And seeing the work ethic.
I remember the first time I saw you guys play live, we had been working together when I was working for Rob Stevenson, and you guys were in town. One of my best friends is cousins with your tour manager. So yeah. We were just chilling. We hung out with you guys. Shout out to Sid and Reggie.
Yeah.
But I remember being backstage at Irving Plaza watching you guys and didn't know exactly what to expect because I had never seen you guys before. And the second you guys hit the stage, it was just an explosion. And watching the crowd react, and I still have a video that I saved from that. When you guys, I think it's Million Fans, when you guys go down into that little like dance breakdown.
Yeah. Or the one we...
You guys do the step that you guys do.
Oh, that's like, doing the most.
Oh, doing the most. Yeah. But just watching the fans, and you guys were such a young band at the time, watching the fans react to that and just go fucking nuts was insane. And that's another thing that I think has carried you guys, is just how great you guys are at connecting in the live show.
That's very much what our identity was before the pandemic, because the truth is, like, the last 4 or 5 years, we just haven't been a band. So we're just getting back into it. And what's beautiful about it is all that work we did do for 7 years of being a touring live act or whatever, that was our business. It shows how much people loved and cared about us. And even people, when it comes to booking us, they still would want to book us. Like, we got playing Cannabis Festival this weekend is because we're known as an energetic, great live act. And that being something that you actually broadcast to the world and show and people experience is so important, and it energized us to be like, we could do this well into our 40s and 50s. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you could be a great band and you don't have to have the biggest song in the world. You could just be a great live act and build that business and build your audience and that relationship that we're talking about. Foo Fighters, do they have the most monthly listeners? No, but all those monthly listeners probably seen them live. Where that's, you can't say the same shit about like anybody.
I feel like that's a more sustainable way to build a career. They always talk about your super fans, like the people who actually care enough to buy tickets, buy merch, stream your record. And a live band, you're forming that genuine connection with that audience while you're doing that. Whereas if you just have a big pop hit and it gets, you know, 100 million streams on Spotify, but nobody thinks of you outside of that hit, that's not sustainable. What you guys did was sustainable.
Yeah. And for us, in our perspective, we're on like a rebuilding process. Like, it's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like your muscles deteriorate and now you got to like eat the protein and lift again. And it feels good to try to like do that, even though now obviously there's still people who love us and we can go play shows, but it's trying to build that and be like, how can this be forever, long term?
And how does it feel now that you're back in the saddle with all that?
Feels great. I mean, I just got off a call. We got some shows, little run in October. We got a DC event called Red Gold Green Weekend that we're doing in June. So that shit should be dope. We have 2 shows in one day this Saturday.
And does it feel different being on stage now than it did pre-pandemic? Are you re-energized because you had that long break from it?
It's definitely a re-energized. I mean, being older feels different. but that's more so if you're in shape or not. But it's more so, I feel way more energized. I think the band in general feels way more energized because we just, you know, we're doing like 196 shows in a year before, you know? So it just felt like this is what we do. Like it didn't even feel, it felt great every single time, but it didn't feel like it did in the beginning. And it feels more like you're more excited.
Do you think you guys will go back to playing that 196 show a year schedule?
A lot of that isn't smart to do when you think about it, but we would if it makes sense, if it's profitable and it makes sense. But sometimes you're playing shows or you're doing a whole tour and you want to get in this situation and you're doing different opportunities. One thing we learned about touring, just got to drop gems because we're talking, is you have to play your own headline shows, even if it's one person at that place, because you're never going to build your headline numbers without playing headline shows. So we played a lot of opening gigs and only did like one nationwide tour where we were headline. So that was a thing where then a good supporting act, it seemed like a lot of people were like, yo, come on the road with us. But sometimes you'll be like, nah, we're going to do our thing and then we'll go on the road with y'all. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason why you wouldn't play 196 shows, because you wouldn't open for 7 people in a year type shoot.
And I know you were still doing your solo stuff through that pandemic and everything. And you've had a great career so far as a solo artist as well. And you've had a lot of high profile collaborations, songs that did really well. But if I'm not mistaken, you don't really play solo shows as often, right?
Nah, not at all. I think I opened up for Joyner Lucas. I played a festival with like Post Malone, Migos and stuff like that. I feel like I'm going to play my first show when I have 500,000 monthly listeners. That was a goal of mine. I might do something, but it's like I'm with the band anyway, so maybe I'll just open for myself. You know what I'm saying? Or even like somehow do the King, like when I really put out the King Breeze show, like on YouTube or something like that, somehow do a bridge between a podcast thing and a show, something like that. It's like I want to do the show, but my favorite version of a show is having a band on stage. So I feel like no matter what, it'll be the same. But also I just want to, I kind of want to build the fan base of people who care and love the things that I do when it comes to everything that I do. You know what I'm saying? And then build off of that.
I love that idea doing the live podcast combined with the show. I think that's really cool. I think that's a perfect transition here then. Let's go back. It's COVID. Obviously, you guys have to come off the road. What happened during COVID? What led to you jumping on TikTok and then kind of get into what you've been doing since then?
We made an album really focused on songs that would get us licensed and playing live, right? That was 2019. We played another 180, 90 shows that year, right? And we were kind of pushed and heralded into this American Cali roots reggae scene, because that's the only scene in America that's kind of like touring based. Like they build their fan base from touring. And so we were playing all these shows while getting like sings, our shit being in video games, TV shows, just to make sure we're generating income and getting our songs out there. And at the end of that year, we're like, all right, let's break out of this and really do our national headline tour the second time around and focus on building our own numbers. That was planned for like 40 dates, starting March 13th, 2020. March 13th, 2020 is literally the day the World Health Organization told the world that it's a pandemic. And basketball, everybody went home. I remember seeing LeBron come off the court saying, oh, we can't be playing this. So we canceled our entire tour and did a live stream what we were going to play on tour to give everybody like a show and try to generate some income. So that happened. So now I'm moved away from Miami because Florida was crazy during the pandemic. I'm sitting in Virginia at my bro's crib and I'm like, like, what do I do? You know what I'm saying? I'm still, you know, writing songs and trying to get shit in film and TV and all that type of shit. But it's like, what do I do? I go on TikTok and start making TikToks about making songs and rapping. And I started understanding TikTok and have building a community, and it turns into the King Green Show. And the King Green Show is really just this concept of, this is all the shit that I'm into. And if you fuck with me, this is the King Green Show. You know what I'm saying? This, there's no, like, you don't go to this channel and get the King Green Show. You don't watch this piece of content and that's the King Green Show. It's like, I am the King Green Show. That's like the whole thing. What I kind of understood what TikTok was and what the internet was is like, this is your own TV channel. So here it is. So then I just started doing that and started making content for money and working with Amazon, working with Google, working with Microsoft, getting deals and shit like that. And then still doing songs for TV and film, as well as making songs on my own, showing people the process. That was really the thing that I was into, showing people the process, because I'd make songs every day. So I was like, let me just show how I make songs every day. Then those songs started going viral. Like, I had a couple of viral moments on TikTok and people listening to it. And I have like millions of plays on songs. And I put out a mixtape and the mixtape does okay. And then I signed a deal because of the mixtape. And that was the first, like, I'm like, what, 33 or something like that at the time. And that was the first time I ever put out a rap project, is at 33. Yeah. And it's all kids listening to my shit. So it's like, made me kind of understand the scope and vastness of music and what it really means nowadays, and how much being a creative person matters more than what's been sold to us as far as like what an artist is. Like, they told you what an artist is and told you an artist needs to be, at one time, needed to be mysterious. Then they told you an artist needs to show you their entire life. I need to know who you're dating and all that type of stuff. They keep telling you what an artist needs to be after artists naturally do something and become successful. Now they're like, oh, that's what an artist is, because look at how successful they are. When an artist is just an artist, once you decide to do some shit, that's what you are. If you become successful or not, that's just the luck of the draw type shit. So that's kind of where all that started, and where the King Green Show started is I had shit nothing to do and I wanted to talk to people about rap. That's literally it. Yeah. It's like, I had nothing to do. It's like, I'm thinking all these thoughts about rap songs are coming out. I'm like, yo, let's talk about music, because I got nobody to talk about music with. It's just me and my bro in the crib.
But I feel like it evolved into more of that. It's centered in hip hop, but you're talking about more than just hip hop now. You're showing more than just the process, right? At what point did you say the King Green Show is more than just me showing people my process and talking about hip hop?
Just like in music, you like listen to a band or artist you like and you start sounding like them. You know, as a kid, you listen, then you're like trying to sound like them, and then you find yourself, or you mesh or blend things together and find yourself. Making content, at first I was just making other people's content, and then I realized, when I started to frame it as the King Green Show, I'm just talking whatever I feel like about the day or that time. So there's no plan in it, because if I start trying to niche myself down, you might grow quicker, but you also people can get sick of you quicker. When you are just the guy that does this, they're like, oh, that's the guy that does this. The one thing I realized, what I'm even driving more towards even now, is being the rapper version of Gary Vee. That makes more sense to me than anything else, because I love hip hop culture. I love rap. Like, it's just the love that I have for it. And then music in general is something I'm fascinated by. Technology and marketing, all those things are like the things that I'm fascinated by, but it's because they all kind of play into each other. All those things are kind of the same thing to me. I was talking to a friend the other day and I was telling her that a rapper is a sociologist. By nature, a rapper has to assess the world where it's at, talk about the world where it is, and understand human nature and how a society works, and then implement themselves within that society. And the better they are at that, the more listeners they're going to have, because they're speaking to this society, right? And that's how a rapper is so integral to now, more so than the past or the future. Rap's about now. And like how the world's working now, right? And so is a marketer. A marketer is a sociologist. They need to understand what people are thinking, how people are moving, understand trends and hive mind and communicate to them so they could sell. And I think that's the interesting part to me. Same thing if you think about a technologist, even though a lot of technologists are just looking towards the future, but if you're trying to sell your technology and you're thinking about what people need now,
For sure. I think that kind of ties back to something that I've been saying for probably like a year now. I feel like as creators, as technology is advancing so quickly, it's that much easier to have like a professional studio at your disposal, whether it's visual, music, writing. But on the flip side of that, all the fans and consumers are so used to a million different new things a day that everything's kind of shortened in terms of the cycle of relevancy for each piece of content. Yeah. So we're almost in like a Renaissance man era. You know what I mean? Where you've got to be able to produce content so quickly that maybe you're not just a singer or a rapper or a writer. Like you have to be able to do all these different things because you have to be able to put out content constantly without burning out.
No, I completely agree with you. It's like the whole world has changed like that. Like I think about the idea of like a Starbucks or a coffee shop. Places are these one-stop shops for all these experiences. That is how an artist needs to be. The same way that even working at a company, they expect you to do so much more now. Like when I talk to my corporate friends and stuff like that, there's like, they expect you to be like this well-rounded person. The same thing of going into college. It's like, oh, did you play sports and were academically successful? It's like the idea of a well-rounded jack of all trades human being is in all facets. But now speaking art in general, one thing I don't like is when people are like, why can't we be musicians anymore? And I understand that statement in the sense of that there's obviously a problem with streaming and songwriters being compensated. And there's these singular roles in the music industry that got created that are losing their value, or there's less positions in that situation. But at the same time, there was more positions in recent times in that space than ever before. When Motown was making hits, it was a group of guys making those hits and then they're putting artists in that space and that's it. And you ain't really breaking into that system. And those are the guys making hits, or you weren't breaking into the music industry very easy at all back in the day. It's the easiest time to be in the music industry ever. So to push back from, so I agree with that. Shit's hard and fucked up when it comes to streaming money and certain jobs are being gone and a lot of this shit's going to hell. But the point I'm saying is like, it started that way. It started when Frank Sinatra's in a movie, he's singing the song, he's acting, you know what I'm saying? He's a full-on artist. These Rat Pack guys are full-on artists. Back in the day, you were everything. You were just a creative and artist and you could sing and you're gonna dance, you're gonna do all that. That's what happened back in the day. And if you want to go even back and further, before we could record music, you're playing shows and you're almost like a court jester. You're like, you got to do anything to get somebody's attention. And you're competing with the circus. A traveling tour was a show of comedians and anybody who performed, right? As industries got changed and moved around, like in the 50s, 60s, that's when things started getting separated and categories got made and by genres even got made, right? To categorize things and make people understand things. So only thing I push back on that about you've got to be a Renaissance man. It's like, that's what, if you really think, know yourself as a creative, just like you're a creative person and work in a creative industry, you can do a lot of shit. Everybody who's creative can do a lot of things. You are never just one thing. The industry made you categorize you and say that you're a songwriter. What is a songwriter? It means you can't be an artist because you're a songwriter. They can't say that you're a producer or you're that. And then you start making money off of it. So you go around saying, oh, I'm a producer. That's just a category that this industry created. What are you talking about? You're a creative person and you just found out a way to make money with one of your strongest talents. That's just it.
I love that. And it also brings up another important point about this is people say like, why can't we just be musicians anymore? But if you think about it, the way things are now, it's easier to make more money as a musician now than it was ever before. Because for everything that you used to have to have a massive team of 400 people doing each individualized task. Now you're looking at it and you're like, well, I could do this, 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 and this all by myself. And I could put it out through this method and I'm going to take all that money. I don't necessarily need the label. I don't need this. I need that. I could just do all this myself.
Exactly. That's exactly. It's like the idea of being an artist right now is people are fighting against an old idea and the reality of what a creative or artistic person is. This title content creator has a bad rap because the word content doesn't mean art, even though it's a business term for art. Like movie companies have been calling movies content since the 50s, right? And it just got broadcasted and massively adopted, right? But you're really just an art creator. You're just a creator. The fact that it's content means that it's valuable. You're creating catalog. So however that content creates money, you should be okay with it as a creative, is how I see it. Because money is, you just need money to live, right? And money to buy the things that you want. But to say you're like, yo, I remember when an artist could be an artist, or a musician could just be a musician. It's like, when was that? When? I don't remember when you had to make music videos and be on MTV, you were just being a musician. When you had to like travel the world so people could, touring used to be the only way you sold records before. Now, after that, you're talking about when you had to have payola to get onto radio. So wait a minute. All those times are way harder to make it than now. Right now, I know kids personally who've made songs on their phone that have more plays than I may ever have. Like on one song, do they have like huge fan bases and real? That's a different thing. But kids that make songs on their phone, the beat from YouTube, they put a headset in and they rap into a band lab and got millions of plays and get a deal. And now they got $300,000 in the bank account. Yeah. Like, what are we talking about? This is the easiest time to make music. A lot of times people who are thinking the old way are looking at it and being like, this is hard. It's like, oh, I can't get my music out. One, your music might be old. Your music might not make sense for who you're trying to present it to. So you may have to present it to a different audience or in a different way. You know what I'm saying? That's one thing. Two, I mean, if you're not an extrovert and don't like making content, maybe someone else should be making content for you. Or maybe you're thinking about content in a different way. And who says you need to be the content? Be creative and figure out another way for people to get used to your music, your work, or interested in who you are as an artist. Getting people interested in you as an artist has been a task since the beginning of time, since there was court jesters basically having to convince the rich and the royalty that their shit was valuable, like Mozart and all of them. It's like they're getting backed by all these monarchs and real money at the time. Same way we've been doing it now for a while, but now you can actually create all this bullshit yourself. The money could come straight to you. You just have to put in the work. And any success that I don't have, I could look at all the things. There are factors and things that can push you back, but there's also opportunities that you can get yourself. So if you focus and work on those opportunities and make that the way you get bread or become successful or break out, do that.
Yeah. And you have always been technologically forward. You've always been open to new things. And I know you dropped that Reel/TikTok the other day about AI music. So that's another topic that I love talking about, because I look at AI, it's a tool to have in your tool belt to help you do things that maybe aren't your strong point and to supplement what you're actually doing. What are your thoughts on AI in general as, you know, text to prompt sort of a tool to create art? And what are your thoughts on AI music and how you see it factoring into your own career?
Being able to tell AI to make some drums would be great. What if I told AI, which I kind of already did, I tell AI to make a 60 soul song about modern dating or something like that. Then I sample that song and make a hip hop track out of a sample that I had AI do, right? That's dope. That's a dope use case for AI. Now, companies using AI and take up space within the world of music and streaming and all that type of stuff and sync licensing, I don't like that at all. But there's also nothing I can do about that other than creating my own space in that community. So it's a double-edged sword, but I see technology the same every single time. I'm just one of those people. Before, you made music and you had to play it live. The only way people could hear your song was live. Then the record got created. Now they could listen to your records, what, in the late 20s or something like that? Now people could listen to your records. After that, it turned into compact cassettes, compact CDs. From there, it went to digital MP3s, then to streaming. All those technologies changed how the music business works and how people perceive music. But at the end of the day, great songs always won. In any of those times, the great songs always won. Not the greatest, maybe, we don't know, but great songs always win in those times, and a song's always going to carry over. So humans are always going to matter as long as humans exist. When humans don't exist, then, like, and the kids are like, they're in the digital cameras. just 20-year-olds and college-age kids are taking digital cameras out and taking pictures rather than using their phones because they like the aesthetic, they love the time, they like the like realness of it. To them, that's real, right? Or vinyls are like the most bought physical good, even if they don't listen to it, because the aesthetic and the vibe of it is, and humanity is really what they're into. So I think that's the same case when AI music comes along, is that will the new iPod commercial maybe have an AI song, or your local gas commercial have some AI music under it? That's guaranteed. It's already happened. So that's cutting out people's bread. But the real songs, like Nelly's Hot In Here. I don't know why I brought that song up, but it came out of my head. Nelly's Hot.
Glad you did.
You know what I'm saying? I had to pull something like that. How ubiquitous it is. But anyways, Nelly's Hot In Here is going to guarantee going to be in some food commercial at some time because of the person who's picking a song for it understands the relevance of Hot In Here, who Nelly is, and who he means to the culture and the people that we're advertising to, which is people our age right now, right? So when we hear Hot In Here and then we see Taco Bell, we're going to be like, oh, we're going to pay attention to whatever that ad is, or if it's on the Super Bowl or whatever. So humanity and the reality of that situation is what's being brought out of that, whereas some random AI song in a trailer for a video game that we don't even like because that game is the same as the other game that we just saw 17 times, we're not going to really care about.
Another thing that all of those technological advancements in terms of the release of music have in common is that people pushed back when those different forms of music came, right? So like, I even remember for myself, the big one for me, because I was old enough that I was ingrained in CDs. I had 1,000 CDs, and then the iPod came. I was like, fuck that, man. I had this wall of CDs that I'm so proud of. I'm not getting an iPod. And then I gradually went to it. Same with streaming. I was like, why do I want to stream? I have all my songs on Napster or my iPod or whatever. Why do I want to download Spotify? And now I live on Spotify all day long, not just for music, but for podcasts, audiobooks, you know.
And you don't own those podcasts. You don't own those songs. You're just getting access to listen to them. That's the interesting part. We gave up the idea of owning music.
That brings back to another thing that you mentioned that I really related to, and that's people love buying vinyl and they don't even listen to it. I have a vinyl record collection that I love. And I look at it, but I look at it as art, and it's a connection to the band or the artist that I really love. The other thing that I was going to say about AI is it's just the evolution of the artist, right? It's the evolution of what an artist can do. Like when hip hop came out, people were like, they're sampling records. You're taking money out of guitarist's pocket or a drummer's pocket. And then there's all that pushback, you know, even Bob Dylan going on stage with an electric guitar. And everybody was like, what is this guy doing? This is sacrilegious. And what it comes down to is you can adapt and move forward and be a part of that movement, or you could hope that you're a big enough artist in the way you're putting things out that that legacy artist who isn't going to adapt because they're too old, that they're still going to fuck with you in the way you're used to, you know, putting shit out.
That's the dope point about Bob Dylan bringing an electric guitar on stage and people being like, what the hell is this? Why don't you have an acoustic guitar, or just like electric guitars in general, or MPCs and sampling? It's like, as technology comes in, the old school people are going to be like, that's not real music. They literally said that. They said an electric guitar is not real music. They said an MPC is not real music. And people are going to say AI is not real music. And obviously, as we know, it's about how things are used. It's about the humanity behind it from my perspective. And when I said the humanity part, when I said as long as humanity exists, I'm not almost even talking about like some nuclear warfare and us not having resources. I'm saying like if artificial intelligence is actually another intelligent thing competing with us in society, that's an interesting thought. Like King Green's putting out a song, and also King Purple, the AI, is putting out a song who thinks for itself and is creating art from a new place and not just copying other artists' art. That's a possibility, right? But looking at technology as this is a tool and how can I use it has always been my perspective. Looking at music as a forever growing organism and not thinking about time periods and what real music is and what real music isn't is just how I was built, because being a hip hop artist, it's like hip hop is a postmodernist art form where it's about dissecting the reality around you and saying that there's not an actual truth. So sampling things
is literally, there's no genre attached to hip hop. You take Lou Reed and you make a hip hop song. You take disco, you make a hip hop song. Anything can be hip hop. And that's why I love it and why I can never really die, that like spirit and understanding of hip hop culture.
A lot of the times when you're talking about even taking hip hop aside, a lot of times when you're talking to songwriters in any genre, it's like, well, how'd you come up with that song? It's like, well, I had the chord progression from this other song and then I just switched it like this. So everything is in a way derivative of its influence.
And that's kind of the point I'm saying of hip hop and the culture. It's about acknowledging that versus saying you're making something spontaneous and this is its own thing. It's acknowledging the fact that all this is the same. It all comes from the same place and it all can be one thing.
I think that's actually one of the things that makes music so special, because it's not just like these little staccato, unconnected things. Everything is one big lineage. And when you come up with a piece of music and it's good and it fits into that lineage, you're part of something bigger. You know what I mean? I think that's such a cool way to look at it.
100% agree with that. I always felt that way. Like, you ever, you know, when you like work in the music industry or you meet someone on music, especially earlier on, it's like, oh, you make music too, or you're into music. And they could be into a whole different genre of music, but you guys are connecting on that love for it. And then now they put you on. Like, I remember being in middle school or something like that and seeing Sublime CD and Incubus CD, and it was ingrained in my brain, like that Sublime logo, and I didn't know nothing about Sublime. And then they played Santeria and all these other songs, and I'm just full-on hip-hop, Wu-Tang, Mos Def, everything hip-hop, every rapper in the world at the time I'm listening to, and I'm like, yo, this shit's dope. And I'm listening to beats like, yo, that beat's kind of like a hip-hop beat. Or I remember, what was that band? Oh my God, Fred Durst. Limp Bizkit, hearing like Nookie and listening to the verse part and be like, yo, that's a rap beat. And then it goes into this rock part. I didn't like the chorus because I didn't like the sound of distorted guitars at the time. I remember that distinctly. I was like, distorted guitars make no sense to me. And now it's like my favorite sound in the world. So it's like, that's such an interesting thing where I saw myself become into different genres. And I remember those moments where I started deep diving into genres and why, from other people, connected to them, being around them and all that type of shit. And that CD case, I saw the Sublime CD and the dude's full on CD case. And since I have a CD case full of hip hop and he has a CD case, we switching CD case and looking at our CDs. And that shit, that's dope, in like math class or some shit, you know? That's part about CDs in that time, whereas now you might share playlists. Like, the sharing of music became interesting. It's still there, obviously, but it's definitely different.
Everything ebbs and flows like that, I feel like. And there will be a time where there's going to be something that gives a visual representation like you're talking about, where, you know, you sit down in math class and you see somebody's got like some piece of technology or something that even attached to their digital profile, and you're going to become friends with that person because of that.
Yeah. I think that's the interesting thing, and still the interesting of like blockchain technology and NFTs. Like I always said, when NFTs came out, people are going to have NFTs and not know it, because once they're connected to a physical thing, like your wallet and your identity within this online universe is going to be more connected. Just like how someone goes to Instagram and it's almost like your resume. You know what I'm saying? Like, or if you have a YouTube, that's a job, right? People think that, oh, you're a YouTuber, you have a career. You're a TikToker, it could be like a career. You're not an Instagrammer, right? Instagram is just your actual resume. It's a CV to people. It's like your social CV. For online, I think when that becomes connected to your identity with like what you purchase and all that type of stuff, I think that's when what you're talking about is really going to exist. I wonder how it's going to be, because it's like, I don't know when physical and digital are going to be merged where they're closer to the same thing. Like when everyone's walking around with glasses and seeing things that are not there.
Yeah, Neuralink.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That's a technological step never going to do.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you, but I know we've only got a couple of minutes here left. So just in closing, any notes for independent artists, people trying to make it now, or anything you want to push that where people could find you and that sort of a thing?
Yeah. I'm a firm believer of you got to make the content that you want to make and people will find you, right? Promoting yourself is almost senseless in 2024. Like the old concept of promoting yourself is like, hey, I got a business over here. Hey, I got a business over here. It's we're here, you know, we're open. that seems very point. Like if I open up a restaurant, the first thing I'm doing is having social media presence and showing people the experience. My favorite understanding, like the luxury brands and Nike. Luxury brands don't tell you when new things drop with commercial. They just attach a brand or lifestyle or identity to their brand and realize that that's going to make people understand what type of brand that they are, right? So it's like, oh, let's put the most famous movie theaters with our cologne. So when they walk through the airport, people are like, oh, that's Brad Pitt. Oh, he did this ad for Dior. That makes Dior look more prestigious, right? Which even people understand that more so now. So that when they see something that simple, it seems like an ad, but they still might love Brad Pitt. It still puts those two identities together. And now I feel like you showing who you are, what you are, and giving a story to whatever you're doing is going to bring people to whatever you're selling, what your product is. They'll find it on your own. The number one thing is that you just have to have the product. A lot of times people will focus on the content and there's no product. If you don't have a product, no one's going to buy anything. And that's the thing with when you put me on the Substack and building a community and stuff like that, the community part is part of something that can be a product if you're interested in doing that, as well as just having content as catalog, just like movies. You got to think of yourself as a studio. If you have a YouTube page and you have all those videos are things that people can rewatch, and you should think of yourself as Seinfeld, and you need to like sell your videos to this streaming place, or you own this catalog or the series, right? And if you're same thing with your albums, if you own your albums, now you own this catalog, you could sell these albums for $1 million. So to thinking about independent artists and thinking about where I'm at and what I want to achieve, it's about creating value, the products that I'm putting out there, and just being myself through my content. And I think everybody should do that, whatever that is. And art, being yourself through your art. Because it's content when you talk about business, but when you're making it, you need to think about it as art. When I make a video and post it on Instagram and TikTok, I'm a grown-ass man. I have to love what I'm talking about and care about what I created. I made a video, edited, talked. You know what I'm trying to say? You're like acting, it's performance media, not social media. So it's like, I love doing that. If I didn't, I wouldn't do it. So if you don't like doing it, find somebody else to do it for you. And it's a King Green show.
That is a perfect point to end on. If you're doing it for the wrong reason because you think it's going to make you an influencer or famous, then don't do it. You're not going to be able to.
Why would you want that? I want to be an influencer. That's a weird thing to want to be. Same thing as wanting to be famous. It's like, what do you actually want? You know?
Yeah. It's about the journey of being able to create. It's not about, well, one day I'll be famous if I do this. Because what is fame? You know, like, what does that really give you?
None of those things are actually real things. Whereas wanting to be an artist can be a thing, but you're an artist once you start creating art. And wanting to make money off your art is a whole different other thing. So you need to think about it like a business. That's perfect. Yeah. Wanting to like make money off your art, that's a perfectly sensible thing to want to have. But wanting to be famous, that was always weird to me. Yeah. Even wanting to be a rapper, I know I'm still going on a rant. Wanting to be a rapper seems always weird to me. Do you love rapping? Do you love writing? Yeah. Or want to just be a rapper? You know what I'm saying? It's two different things.
Yeah, that's a huge distinction that I don't think I've ever really thought about that. Like, do you want to be a rapper or do you want to rap? Such an important distinction.
It's a huge distinction. Like being an MC, a writer, or the rapper archetype is like, I have to wear these chains. I have to look this way, get all these women. I make money. There's this archetype that people think of a rapper and someone wants to be that. Or do you have a love and desire of this music and this culture and writing raps? And that's what you love. You know what I'm saying? My whole life, never cared about that rapper part and always loved rapping.
Well, dude, I appreciate you so much for being on this podcast. That was a great interview, and I'm very thankful.
Dope. Thanks for having me, man.
Are you ready?